Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we celebrate Dune. No, not that Dune. We're talking about that old polarizing one that David Lynch directed. We discuss everything that's keeping 1984's Dune from achieving Frank Herbert's ultimate intent with the novel, as well as all of the idiosyncrasies that allow Lynch's existential tale about the self to shine in enigmatic, bizarrely beautiful ways.
We're about to record a podcast, and I have to think of an intro. I wonder what Travis is thinking. I wonder if the audiences will like my intro.
I guess what I'm...
audiences.
Audiences implies more than one person is listening to this podcast, and I don't know if that's true. it's just my mom out there. Hey, Mom. Does Virginia Madsen whisper her little opening monologue in the movie?
No.
No.
Is that the implication?
No. It's just people have the little like.
Oh yeah, okay.
They whisper throughout. It's like,
yeah, we get everybody's internal monologues.
Yeah, just randomly and explicitly.
I don't want to get into talking about the movie too much yet.
Inexplicably.
But this whole motif of people hearing people's thoughts is sort of unbearable at points. Like when Max von Sydow was like, I like this Duke. Against all better judgment, I like this Duke. There's like really dumb shit like that. Yeah. But it's part of why I love this movie is that like it is so ridiculous. And like it almost becomes part of an aesthetic choice, like of how cheesy it is. I don't know. There's just something about it that I think both doesn't work and shouldn't happen and does work. And I'm happy that it's happening.
I mean, it feels very much like David Lynch is like, well, books have internal monologue. I'm going to put an internal monologue.
Well, there is a reason behind why we hear all that, but we can get into that as we go.
Okay. So David Lynch's Dune. Whatchamacallit? How many times, what's your background with this movie?
So I am an avid David Lynch fan. I would say Mulholland Drive is one of those movies that kind of solidified my eternal relationship with movies, how important they are to me. So that movie is kind of like the sun and all the other movies he made are revolving around them. Like even the ones I don't like, I have some sort of kinship with and understand on a level that I think most people, not that most people don't, that sounds pretentious, but then your average person who thinks Lynch is weird and doesn't get his movies would. So I've always really loved David Lynch. I love Twin Peaks. Huge fan of Eraserhead. Even Inland Empire, Chris's greatest enemy in cinema. I love all of his movies. But I will say Dune is the one I didn't see for the longest time. And it wasn't until, I believe it would have been 2018, 2019. I remember I was in my new apartment in Chicago when I watched this for the first time, and I was in the midst of I thought I was going to commit to this, and I haven't done it, and I haven't really even come close to doing it, but I still keep thinking about doing this, is writing this big retrospective on Lynch's career, like going through each movie and showing the connections and showing how you can properly like watch his movies and get the most out of them. So I decided to watch Dune, and I think I watched Dune, there are several versions of Dune. There's obviously the theatrical cut, which we're talking about on the show today. But there's the mini, there's like the TV cut of it that was 180 minutes long. And David Lynch put, I forget the name, but it said directed by like Alan Smithy. I forget the name. It's something like that. And it's like a name directors use when they want to detach themselves from the movie and say like, I had no part in this. I watched that version for the first time, and that's publicly regarded even by fans of Dune as like a pretty bad version of it. Like even Lynch, you saw the dude we saw, David Lynch put his name on that. He wouldn't put his name on this movie. So like, it must have been pretty bad, whatever cut they did. I saw that early on, and I didn't have the proper TV setup, I will say. Like, I was in like a big apartment, and not a big apartment. I didn't have a lot of money to be buying a big apartment in Chicago, but like the room I was in was pretty spacious, and I was kind of far away from the TV and not good sound. I didn't really watch it for the first time, in my opinion, until I saw the theatrical cut, Arrow's 4K transfer of the theatrical cut, and got debilitatingly high while watching it. Like the kind of high where you sink into the couch and you're like, oh, I'm going down and I'm not getting back up. The kind of high that and usually when it happens for me is more accidental. Like, I don't want to be that high, but when it starts happening, I'm just like, all right, falling to the couch. Like, here we go. So I watched the movie that way, and I found it very transcendent in the kind of way being that high can do. It's the kind of movie that, it's so atypical from what we expect from it. Like, I think that's a big reason why people love the new Dune a lot, is like, it's discernible. Like, that's a big part of it. Like, being able to understand what the fuck's happening. But I felt in that state, I kind of did understand the movie, at least on a thematic and like philosophical level. Like, I saw what it was doing. I saw the visuals. I saw how they connected. I understood the aesthetic. Even if some of the choices are ridiculous and obviously done by the studio, like, I can see the Lynchness in it, 'cause I know Lynch so well. So I had a profound connection with the movie at that point, and then since have seen it twice, just regular, not being super duper high, including this morning when I watched it. And yeah, I still kind of had the same reaction to it, where like, I recognize its flaws. Like, I know what's wrong with it. I get why it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I see it, I get it, and I love it.
As I was watching, I just kept thinking, this is perhaps one of the most Travis movies I've ever seen. Like, maybe perhaps one of the most Travis movies to ever be made.
You were correct.
Which was, I couldn't get over that. I was just like, that's a Travis. That's going to make Travis laugh. That's going to make Travis laugh.
I agree. There are movies I love that like everyone seems to love, like Mulholland Drive or Enter the Void or something like that. But then like, this is in the category of Showgirls, you know, where it's,
yeah,
this is a crime against humanity that someone made this. And I'm like, it's kind of good though.
I mean, Showgirls, I think, is actually good.
Yeah, of course. Of course you do. Well, that's how I feel about Dune. I watch it and I'm like, it's actually pretty good.
Okay. So I'm like not a huge David Lynch fan in general. I've slowly been catching up on his works. I really like Mulholland Drive, but I've only ever seen Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire, and now Dune. So,
oh wow,
I've only seen three of his films.
Well, you can't. Well, okay, so you've only liked one of his three films then.
Yeah.
So that's not a great track record.
No, it's seeming like there might be a disconnect with me and
David Lynch, but you watched two of his movies that kind of everyone agrees aren't his best.
Yeah, that's true too. I haven't watched, I don't know, what's it considered his second best movie?
Most people would probably say Blue Velvet. I would actually just say Eraserhead. My other pick would be Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, but I think that only pays off once you've watched the show.
Okay. Well, so I only know late stage Lynch, when it seems like he was maybe at his most indulgent.
Oh, for sure.
So it was very jarring to see David Lynch do a movie like this, which is a lot more. I mean, it's very David Lynchy, I guess, in a lot of ways. But the shot selection and the camera movements and the actual vibe of the film, the filmmaking aspect of it felt so antithetical to what I associate with Lynch that mm-hmm. I just imagined him like stewing in the director's chair the entire time, or like he lost a bet, owed somebody money or needed money, that there was just all something that theories. Happened that got him to make this movie as cut and dry as it kind of is. I mean, it's not like it's boring or lacking vitality or anything,
right.
but it's just so far removed from the style of filmmaking I associate with Lynch, and so much more buttoned up.
Yeah.
That, I don't know if early Lynch was all like that, very like buttoned up, and he finally like undid his tie and let loose. But I was really, I was laughing at that a lot of the time too.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, it must have killed him to film that shot just so basic, right like that.
I know what you mean. A big part of why Dune is a failure in quotes, and I kind of agree with this, is that it is just the studio's fingerprints are all over it. And when David Lynch signed up for Dune, you know, it came after he did Eraserhead in 1978. I'm always blown away by how early that film was. It's just such a bizarre movie. It feels modern in a lot of ways, and how like weirdly artistic it is, but it's such an old movie. He made that, and that was made with like, you know, bare bones crew. Like he only worked with 10 people the whole time. That includes actors and crew, and meticulously crafted all of the sound himself, did all of the sets, spent 6 years making it, and, you know, and then it became this thing that got him Hollywood jobs. He got the direct to Elephant Man, and then he rolls in the Dune. And those are two movies suddenly where like he's dealing with a lot of people and dealing with very high-end equipment and has a giant budget like Dune had. And he makes the movie I think he wants with The Elephant Man. Like, it is a very standard biopic in a lot of ways, but it's also super artsy and weird, like a lot of Lynch stuff is. Like, sometimes you're watching it and you're like, is this a dream? But Dune was... it was where he finally lost Final Cut, which he didn't even realize was something that could happen, and he didn't realize was happening when he signed up to do this movie because of the way it was worded in his contract. I think that's the story. But David Lynch slowly found out that he didn't have Final Cut over this movie, that not everything was going to make it on the screen the way he wanted. There were 7 versions of the draft because the financiers and producers kept asking for this or that, and a huge part of this movie was like it was completely mismarketed. Like, it was marketed to like little kids, you know, not like 12-year-olds, but like kids, as like a family friendly movie, like as an outer space movie. Just everything about the movie was kind of a failure on the studio's part, and like trying to make something, like trying to apply to the lowest common denominator, you know.
Yeah, they wanted a Star Wars.
Yeah, they just wanted it to do the things it does, and for people to like it for being dumb and move on and like make a trilogy out of it. Instead, they kind of like, well, it's cheaper just to make one movie and like extract as much from it as we can. And that's really what it became. And all that going into like Lynch dealing with like a gigantic crew, which he's his first time dealing with a crew this big. Like, I feel like I'm not surprised by the result we get. Like, it, in all of those ways, the movie is flawed and isn't like what we expect of a movie to be, like nice and polished and put together. So in that way, it's not very Lynchian, because like a Lynchian movie to me is more like what happened after Dune, where he was so fed up with the studio system that he said, fuck off. Like, if you want me to make a movie, I'm making it my way. And that's what Blue Velvet was. It was him finally like locking into what he wanted from like a bigger budget narrative. And all of his movies from there on out just kind of kept becoming more and more indulgent in what he does, and what he does did so well in Blue Velvet. Dune in that way is not very Lynchian, but there are so many Lynchian things about it that aren't as pronounced and aren't as like necessarily dreamlike as something. You watch Mulholland Drive, you're like, oh, that's a Lynch movie. Like the way it moves and the way you move in and out of dreams and shit. But Dune, it's Lynchian and like, how they're disgusting people, you know, like boils on people's faces, like really interesting looking extras standing around. The way we move in and out of people's heads when we're not sure what we're seeing is like a vision or reality. There are just these little touches that I think Lynch has that unfortunately kind of get buried in what the studio wanted from this big sci-fi movie, but are still there. And if you're really, really high, they're like really there.
Yeah, that's it still felt very much in like not the filmmaking aesthetic, but the like set aesthetic, the design aesthetic.
Totally.
Like those things felt very Lynchy to me. It's just not the the camera work.
Yeah, right.
But it's the editing, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little blocky in how it like sometimes it can't. I think there are actually a lot of beautiful moments with the camera, but it is a little more stilted in that way.
Yeah, I think of him having more of a, like a roving camera or something, just a little more like on the ground.
I know what you mean.
But it was the cinematography is pretty great. There were some
I love it
awesome shots throughout the movie, which was kind of to me the best part about the movie was just how visually beautiful it was. And I could imagine you with the 4K just
getting
and eyeing
it makes the word I think this is true, it makes the movie worth watching. Like of course the movie's looks great. Like I agree with you. I love all of the sets. Like there's not a single frame in this movie where you can't look around and like see cool shit lying around. It's awesome. Or like some really cool ornate wall and you're just like, why is that so extravagant? But it's the kind of movie, in my opinion, that like when you see it pop in the way 4K can offer, especially from Arrow, who's doing really good transfers, like I personally formed a deeper connection with the movie because of that, I believe.
Yeah, I could see that very much being the case. And it did elevate it in ways. Like, I was happy to be watching it because I was so interested in what was going on visually and what they were going to do. And I could imagine watching this in the 80s and truly being like, whoa. But at the same time, just thinking about the fact that this came out in 1984 and Blade Runner came out in 1982 and just the gigantic, I feel like the visuals in Blade Runner are so much more developed and dynamic and interesting. And the graphics at the time or the avant-gardeness of the technology at the time. It's just you would think that Dune is the older movie rather than Blade Runner being 2 years prior to Dune.
It's funny how that can happen when Dune has a way bigger budget.
Yeah, what like the budget for Dune was 40 to 42 million, and what was the budget for Blade Runner?
I mean, today's dollars, that's probably like a $200 million movie or some shit.
I know. I was looking at that and like that had to have been excessive and obscene at the time. Blade Runner's budget was $30 million.
Okay, so not drastic, but still, Dune. I guess more of what Dune is like, it had a bigger image. Like it was Dune. Like they're finally making a Dune. It has all these people's endorsements, including the guy who wrote the book. Like there was just a hype around this movie that built it up to be something bigger than it was.
Yeah, I would have been. I didn't think it was a very good movie. I thought it was a very interesting movie, but the dialogue, a lot of the acting, a lot of the just the sequences and structure of it was just so unbelievably at times dumb, at times just silly, and silly and not like necessarily a bad way. But especially now, one of the reasons I never watched this, especially after seeing the 2021 Dune, was that I didn't want the story ruined before I saw Dune Part 2. And now that I've seen Dune Part 2, now that I've written about Dune and Dune Part 2, or Part 1 and Part 2, and have a better insight into what Frank Herbert was going for with the book... Yeah. The thematic swing and miss on this, which I guess has been the crux of the conversation amongst like book fans for a long time, was just so startling to me. I don't know how well you know Dune the novel, or and how far this is different from the intended thematic purpose of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's pretty accurate in terms of the story beats.
Mm-hmm.
Especially having seen Doom Part 2 and being like, oh yeah, I recognize this, 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 and this. But just the the intention of the stories, Lynch just disregards it because I think they did want a Star Wars movie.
Right.
So they wanted a Luke Skywalker figure rather than something more complicated.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
Yeah, I mean, I totally hear everything you're saying, and I understand it. I mean, it's weird territory for me to step around because I know what people mean when they say things like everything you just said, and it makes me think that like Villeneuve's Dune is like a smart person's Dune, in quotes, kind of. And I really don't mean that because I don't think I'm that fucking stupid. I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but like I like the old Dune. Like that's the kind of Dune I like. I feel like there's an image that the new Dune is more complicated because, yes, indeed, it probably does technically adhere to the book's themes and ideas a lot better because, well, it's a lot longer. Like it has more time and space to navigate those things, to discuss them, and maybe it makes those themes more powerful in other ways too, just like from the cinematography that everyone seems to love. I get it, but I was looking for this quote from Frank Herbert and I can't find it, but he essentially said, you know, when the movie came out, from the day it came out, he remained like a defender of David Lynch's Dune and said, like, you know, everything in my book, like it's right there on screen. The producers came to me and asked me to sign off on Dune and say it was honest to my novel, and like I gladly did it. I didn't like fake it. Like I actually thought David Lynch did a good job, that all of my ideas are there. They're done in a very abstract way. And I guess a lot of people probably would argue that, like, if you don't even fucking understand it, like what's the point of, you didn't do a good job relaying the themes. But that's, I think, only applicable to a certain kind of viewer. And again, I don't mean to demean when I say that. Like I think the ostensible image of a smart movie is what Villeneuve did with Dune, and how it does actually technically cover all the ground and offer you everything in a very like digestible way. But it doesn't mean what Lynch did didn't work. It doesn't mean that he didn't accurately capture all the themes in Dune, in my opinion. And it seems like Frank Herbert agrees, because it's just done in a very visually indulgent, enigmatic way. Like it's all kind of unfolding at a bizarre and anti-narrative manner. Like you don't really like understand what's happening in terms of a narrative, but like you can see all the things that are happening and like see how Paul is changing and like what he's realizing about himself in the universe. There's just so much in it that has that I think typically the image is like, oh, like dumber people like this. Here you go. Like here's like a visually exotic cinematic land that like you can pretend is like doing all this deep stuff. But I guess in my mind, like if you are visually conveying everything in these really weird experimental visuals, then you are covering the ground in a really intelligent way. It's just not the kind of, you're just not doing it the kind of way that's going to appeal to like 90% of movie watchers.
That's all. I agree so much with that, but there's a core. I don't want to spoil Doom Part 2.
Yeah.
For those that haven't watched it yet and might hear this before they go see the movie, though there's like 10 people that might be. Or even for yourself.
Yeah.
But there's like a pretty sizable, it's not just like a difference in like approach to it, but it's like there's a key part of the thematic point of the books that Lynch didn't convey at all.
We might be discussing that actually, because I do think there's one gigantic crime against this movie that even Frank Herbert agrees about. Maybe we'll talk about it.
Yeah, so that's kind of the thing to me where it's like no amount of like visuals or like difference in like approach is what the difference is here.
Yeah,
it's like a core misunderstanding of
yes,
like Paul's journey.
Okay, gosh, I'm scared to talk about it because I feel like I know what you're talking about.
I mean, if you know, I mostly just don't want to spoil things or like get into things for you. But I guess people that are going to watch this episode probably know the book well enough.
I guess so. Maybe we just put a little
1984 film.
We put a little spoiler warning here potentially.
Yeah, spoiler warning. There you
okay.
go.
Okay. So can I say what I think you're going to say?
Yeah. And if I'm wrong, we'll talk about it. Yeah. And if it's wrong, we'll leave it.
Okay. The biggest problem with this movie, and I'll put this first. The other part of me loving this movie is like if I was going to literally look at David Lynch movies and just rank them by like how much I like them in terms of Lynchiness, you know, like that I want a David Lynch movie. Like, what do I watch? Like, I'd probably rank this near the bottom. But part of why I love this movie is that it merges two of my loves, which is weird, enigmatic David Lynch and like so bad they're good movies, or like movies with so bad they're good is just in quotes, by the way, like movies that have this very bizarre story attached to them. It is outside the typical territory we see from movies, which are like, you know, all nice and polished and put together. Like, no, this was a fucking mess. That's what Dune was. And it's why David Lynch to this day will not answer questions about Dune, like does not want to talk about Dune. They shot it in Mexico. It was like super hot. The electricity kept going out. People were getting sick. It was a 6-month shoot. Like he hated the experience. Like I understand. So on that level, like it's part of why I'm fascinated by Dune. It's just like, it's insane that it got made, that this exists, that David Lynch tried so hard to make it a Lynchy movie and the studio just came in and like, you know, put people's voices in and we heard inner monologues and they chopped up all of the fight scenes that made them look stupid and for the soundtrack not to work. And, you know, all these like really dumb choices that clearly weren't done by a filmmaker. Even though those take away from the movie, that's part of why I love the movie. Like, I like reading about the history of movies. I like forming a connection with the movie in that way and kind of understanding it on that deeper level. So, like, while I'm watching it, like, I'm kind of also seeing, like, all of the flaws and, like, everything that prevented it from being more. That's probably why I love this movie. And the biggest thing, the biggest sin that what happened, the biggest sin that that entire relationship brought to this movie was the fact that Paul is seen as a savior figure, as somebody. Yes. Okay, so this is what you're going to talk about.
Yes.
That he's the right person for this moment for the universe to lead them. And I was actually reading about Frank Herbert has this introduction. What's it called? It's called Introduction to I. I don't know if this is a book or something that he wrote, or maybe it's like a memoir or diaries or something. But he has this little passage about Dune. Even though he's sitting there praising Dune and loves what it's doing and thinks it does a lot of it right, it's mostly the ending that he has a problem with. And so this is what he says. Paul was a man playing God, not a God who can make it rain. Dune was aimed at this whole idea of the infallible leader because my view of history says mistakes made by a leader or made in a leader's name are amplified by the numbers who follow without question. That's how 900 people wound up in Guyana drinking poison Kool-Aid. That's how the U.S. said, yes, sir, Mr. Charismatic John Kennedy, and found itself embroiled in Vietnam. That's how Germany said, Sieg Heil. Is it Sieg Heil?
Sieg Heil? Yeah.
I don't know. And murdered more than 6 million of our fellow human beings. Leadership and our dependence on it how and why we choose particular leaders is a much misunderstood historical phenomenon. And that to me is like where this movie could have been powerful and really connect the dots. And I think does do it for most of the movie until the very end when Paul is anointed as like, you know, the one.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That was the thing that I was like, it's really just going down the path of Paul being like the Luke Skywalker figure rather than the Darth Vader.
I know. And that's what I was thinking. I actually had that thought in my head as I was watching it this time, and I had never put the dots together on that was what the movie was maybe trying to do or what Herbert was trying to do. And I had a passing thought of like, he's kind of like an Anakin figure in a way. And then the more I thought about it and read about it, I was like, oh, like that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah, no, that's like, in so much so that I didn't know anything about Dune before watching part one and then part two. And now that I've seen part one and part two and know like what Herbert did, I think a bit less about Star Wars because it went from feeling very original to me with like, sure, he probably had some inspiration to feeling incredibly derivative and in a reductive way. To where I'm like far more impressed with what Frank Herbert was saying than George Lucas turning it into like a theme park ride. Which, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy is still like a great trilogy, and the fall of Anakin is still a great twist on it, like his own story on it. It just feels a little less like the source, right? And now Dune to me is just like, oh, that was where the depth was.
Yeah.
That is where more of the thought is. Though I feel like Dune, the novels get a little messy in terms of just how much stuff they have going on. And
for sure,
maybe how melodramatic it seems like some of the next books gets and the whole world gets. But Dune Part 2, I feel like, boil that story down in such a great way that it meant going from that to this felt very, very
a movie that's trying to be Star Wars.
Yeah. Like that flaw felt all the more apparent, especially after seeing it. I think before Villeneuve's Dune existed, you could just be like, it's a lot. And maybe he missed out on it, but if he did a second movie, maybe he would have gone for it. But then you see how Villeneuve handles it and you're just like, yeah, wow, okay.
Yeah, I'm interested to see it because I imagine it just becomes, I mean, it has just more room and space to breathe in the movie, I imagine. Like, we're exploring that side of Paul.
Yeah, yeah. And that, like, the twist becomes a lot more of a gut punch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. That I'm totally with you in the sense that if it's adapting Dune, it should have that aspect of Dune. That's an important part of Frank Herbert's Dune that's reflective of history and teaches us something. Like, what does the ending of David Lynch's Dune really teach us? What is Luke Skywalker? I mean, obviously they can teach us things, but it doesn't carry the same energy that Frank Herbert intended.
Yeah, which is that superheroes are just normal people that are flawed and we give them all this power and then they end up like fucking us over.
Yeah.
And instead it just feels like at the end of Dune, like, Paul's great, isn't he? He's the one that was chosen. There's also like a whole thing in there that all the Fremen myths that they're relying on to be like, he's the one, were planted by the Bene Gesserit specifically for this purpose. So it's like the myths that add power are just man-made things that they've been manipulated into believing, which is really tragic. That their whole, like, it creates that like underlying falseness to what it means that he's like Lisan al Ghaib, that you don't really get from this movie. And this movie is just like, no, these were the prophecies.
Yeah. I'm going to keep saying the sentence over and over. Like, I know what you mean. Like, I agree with that narrative in general. Like, I think the movie could have done a way better job of conveying that Paul is nothing more than a demagogue. Like, he's the same figure we've seen over and over and over. represents that whole cycle. But I don't think the movie necessarily, like, any moment where it feels like he is being propelled to the savior figure, it feels, again, kind of done by the studio, or done in, like, I guess it's mostly the ending when it rains and, like, the little sister is just awing about him. We get, like, one of some little, I don't even know what she says about him, that, like, announces to everybody, like, how great he is.
He's like, the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah. And the fact that it's, like, raining, which is, like, an act of God. I will say, in the last draft that Lynch wrote for the movie, there was no rain. Like, I still wonder, we'll never know, because David Lynch won't talk about this crazy-ass movie anymore, but how much, because he really did love Dune, and he had a relationship with Frank Herbert and everything, and he had a good relationship with Dino De Laurentiis, and he wanted to make Dune. So, like, I feel like he probably did understand what the book was in some sense, and it just kind of got removed from the movie after the final edit. But the last draft of the script does say, here's the part where we go into Paul's eyes and it goes into, like, an ocean, you know, and then the rain comes. This is what he wrote. We move through Paul's glowing blue eyes into the beautiful blue, luminescent blue light. I wrote blue twice. I'm assuming that's not what it is. It's David Lynch's script. A gigantic wind arises, and suddenly appearing in the blue light is an ocean of light rolling like gold glass off into infinite. The blue becomes darker, and a golden lotus flower blooms in the night. And that's how the movie was going to end. Again, like, not super... it doesn't convey... Like, it's tough to watch that and understand, like, oh, like, I know what the movie's doing. Like, it's this weird experimental, like, dreamlike bit. But to me, like, that all conveys an image of, like, what Paul has become to these people and what he represents, more than it actually lifts him to that status and says, like, this is what we should aspire to. I feel like there is still a sense in this movie of, like, what Paul's doing is a little scary. Like, there's a shot where he's standing in front of the Freeman, standing atop this tower, and it looks straight out of Triumph of the Will. Like, it looks like the exact scene of Hitler speaking to his people. Like, I don't think that's an accident. Like, I think that is an aspect of the movie. It just doesn't land. It doesn't stick the landing at the end, essentially. Like, it doesn't make it as powerful as it should. Like, you're saying that Dune Part 2 probably does.
Yeah, that shot comparison, if there's, like, more stuff like that, would be awesome.
Yeah,
it does seem like the final cut getting taken from Lynch and these producers really wanting their Star Wars moment is what ruined it. I was reading this note about Jodorowsky, and that Jodorowsky was, like, really bitter about it and refused to see the movie for a long time, and when his sons finally got him to watch it, he was happy because it was a failure. But that it was certainly, and this is in, was it in quotes, but that it was certainly the producer's fault and not Lynch's.
Yeah.
So it was Jodorowsky seemed to also pick up on that.
I read this great quote from Jodorowsky, and I don't think he was talking about Lynch's Dune. I think maybe he was just talking about Dune, the book. But he said, like, the great will think Dune is great, and the simple will think it's simple, something like that. I don't know, something to that. But basically, like, you have to be invested in Dune to really get it. And he was probably just jealous in that way, because, like, he got the book. He wanted to make, like, probably what a lot of Dune fans wanted. And instead, we got what came out of a studio hacking up Lynch's version of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of a shame, because you do wonder, is that why everybody for, like, years is like, Lynch's cut, Lynch's cut, Lynch's cut?
I think that I heard this somewhere. I also watched the commentary for this movie, and there was a story about, I mean, obviously there's the whole story that Lynch will not answer questions about Dune. Like, he never talks about it, but recently he finally did answer some questions about Dune. And they asked, like, will there be a director's cut? And he basically said, like, I would like to do it someday, maybe, but, like, there's other stuff I'm just more interested in. I'm still suffering from trauma from the shoot 30, 40 years later. And I'm pretty sure if I looked at the footage, it wouldn't be interesting enough to me to like put it together. So, yeah, I think there is hope that all of it comes together someday. But Lynch, I mean, shit, he's in his 70s now, like, and he wants to keep doing what he does. I'm not sure he's going to go back to Dune.
That's a shame.
Yeah. And I mean, there have been versions and other cuts of it over the years, and there were even like a lot of fan cuts and shit, you know? But I don't know if we'll ever see someone truly invest in, like, I don't know if there's a demand for the old Dune, you know?
Yeah. Apparently the producer, De Laurentiis, said that he had talked with David and David was willing to do it.
When was this?
Just earlier this, or last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and apparently the studio didn't want to pay Lynch anything. And Lynch was just like, that I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, I guess this is going back to, I don't know, I should get more context for it, but it says, for years after, David Lynch told the press he wished to go back and take a second pass. Although a three-hour cut was manufactured by Universal Television, it was about Lynch and De Laurentiis. So I guess this was before that. Well, and that's why they used the Alan Smithy.
Yeah. Part of me wonders, like, I agree that adding certain scenes would help give more context to things and make things make more sense, and maybe he can get rid of that annoying inner monologue. But I'm also kind of like, I like the movie the way it is. Like, I feel like it kind of works. Not kind of. I think it works. Like, I think everything is there to convey the ideas of Dune. Again, very done in a very enigmatic way and not entirely discernible. But to polish it up, to, like, make things make more sense. Sounds terrible to say. Would, like, take away from what I like about Dune.
That sounds exactly like what you would say. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is... It feels in some ways like a spiritual successor to the Mario Brothers movie.
the new one?
The old, like, oh, the original 1990s Super Mario Brothers
definitely
movie.
Definitely has that feel.
I imagine the people that made the Super Mario Brothers movie were just like, I love David Lynch's Dune. It's the best movie. We're going to make our version of Dune.
I mean, that really is like... I guess we can stop talking about how good or bad Dune is at like conveying the themes of Herbert's novel. Cause I think most people disagree, like, nah, it doesn't really stick the landing, but all of the other shit, which to me is important to the profundity of a movie and forming a connection with the movie and understanding it, is all of the costumes, all of the sets, the theatrical acting we're seeing from people. Like, people are just, I love all the performances in this movie. The only bummer to me is Steen, who I think is good, but they don't give him anything to do in this movie, which is ridiculous. Like, you have Steen. Barely... He's going to run around and act like Steen. Like, use that. But I just love the aesthetic of the movie. I love the way it looks and feels. The other thing Lynch does that I mentioned earlier is it's not a typical Hollywood thing to do. It's not a cool thing to do. Like, Hollywood movies have like a bunch of beautiful people standing around. Like, there are a bunch of like odd looking people standing around in a Lynch movie. Like, all of the Emperor's men, like all of his like cabinet guys that like sit down in the chairs together at the end. Like, they're all like old dudes, just like normal looking guys. They look like my dad. I don't know. There's something very enchanting to me about just the investment people had in this movie. I read a quote, I can't remember who it was, but like, he was talking about the atmosphere on the final day of the shoot. And even though like it was such a trying shoot and everyone kind of perceived it as a failure, even as they were making it, like, there was joy at the end of it, like that they had accomplished something, that like all this hard work kind of paid off in a weird way. And I think that comes through in the movie. Like, I think everyone's kind of giving it their all on all angles, even if everything isn't exactly always working and meshing properly.
And all the scenes with the Baron are so, like, you could tell they were Lynch's favorite scenes.
I have insight into this.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I just know that I see scenes like that, and it does make me think of, I haven't watched Villeneuve's Dune in a bit. I'm going to watch it for the next podcast, but I don't remember any sort of, like, humor around the Harkonnens.
No.
And there would be, when the Harkonnens were doing their shoots, Lynch would screw up takes because he would start laughing while they were doing it. Like, to him, it was funny. It's part of also why I love this movie in comparison to Villeneuve's Dune, is like, Lynch's Dune has levity to it. There's more like pop in character in a lot of ways that I appreciate. And yeah, like all the stuff, the Harkonnens, like, it's so insane. Like, nobody, we should all be looking at each other and be like, this is ridiculous, right? Like, it's so absurd in a way that I love and find very entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things as I watched it, I was like, oh, this is one of the reasons Travis feels that Villeneuve's version is so stale in comparison, because you have, you don't have this kind of energy that you're getting right from any group of characters. Everything is so much more severe,
yeah,
and draconian in how it's going, or even the hand in the box scene. Right, when they do the test with Paul, it's like, I find that scene to be very beautiful Villeneuve's in just how tempered it is in the shot selection, mm-hmm, of it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the same visceral liveliness,
right,
of Lynch's, with the graphic of the hand burning and melting and just the difference in like the flow of the scene, where in Lynch's version, it's what, like 2 minutes total, maybe? Mm-hmm. And in Villeneuve's, it's like a 8 to 10 minute scene from the time that you have him walking down. And there's pacing issues that will appeal, not issues, but pacing differences that will appeal to different kind of audiences.
Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying, that, and I understand that. I could see how someone with my kind of taste would prefer the Lynch, and I could see how someone would prefer a more refined, tempered approach that Villeneuve does. I mean, it's not to knock Villeneuve. Like, he's very successful at what he does, obviously, and he has a very specific aesthetic of his movies. But it's just not really what I like to watch. Not even that. Like, I think if done well, it can work. But I maybe it's that I think it's less easy to screw up when you're doing it Lynch's way. Like, don't just talk about the burning hand. Like, show me the fucking burning hand, you know? And he does that.
Right. I need to see it.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I do think that you're going to like, you still might be lukewarm on part one, but I do think that there's more to part two that, even if it doesn't win you over, I think you'll at least be happier with it.
Okay.
Than with part one, but we'll see.
That I'm interested. Could be
famous last words. One thing I didn't understand until I watched the movie, I always hear people jokingly say like spice melange, and I never knew why. I mean, I knew it was from the 1984 Dune, but I didn't have any context for why they would whisper it like that and be like spice. And then watching and having all the internal monologue just be the whisper the whole time.
Oh, for sure.
I was laughing so hard because I just can't imagine what it would have been like in 1984, like coming out of the theater and everybody just quoting this movie to each other. Like, you're at work or you're with friends and somebody says something, and you're just like, why did they do that? Maybe we'll never know. It might be the greatest like gag after a movie, or like my favorite like post-movie reference ever now, because it's just so ridiculous and so humorous.
They've got to know Dune, though, for the joke to land.
Oh, What? Say that again.
Sorry. I just like they need to know Dune for that joke to land, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be whispering to people from now on, thinking I'm being funny, and people are just going to think I'm being creepy.
All that's going to happen is they're going to like, what are you doing? And you're going to explain that it's from Dune. You're going to make people watch Dune. So really what you're doing is spreading the word.
Ah, good point, good point, good point.
So you can see that as a blessing or a curse, I guess.
Yeah.
I see it as a blessing.
I convinced 75 people this month to watch Dune.
Wow, those are good numbers.
Yeah, that would be...
You met your quota.
More people than listen to an episode of this podcast. No, no. We get a couple hundred.
Just a couple.
That's it, though.
All right. Do you have a favorite part in this movie?
Favorite part in the movie... I just keep thinking the one question that kept running through my mind last night was, why do the worms create lightning?
Why would you ask such a silly question?
I know, I know. My favorite part was the inexplicable punishment that the guy had to milk cats that happened to have a rat attached to it.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I still don't really know
what that is.
No, it just seems like... That's not in the book, right? I imagine not.
I don't know. I haven't read the book.
Yeah, I don't think it's in... I mean, I guess I should Google it right now real fast. Dune, is there cat milking? By milking this smooth little cat, it's never adequately explained why the cat is in the contraption or what milking a cat's body entails. I don't think it's in... I don't think it's in the novel. So that was absurd to me and pretty wonderful. And then I guess the worms were cool as well.
Yeah. But very 1980s version of that, monster.
Very much. Very much so. And, probably just those two things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would do it.
I love a lot of little bits in this movie that I think are just like, again, this is appealing to the like, how did this get made so bad it's good part of my brain that I'm like, yeah, this movie was dumb and like didn't work, but like it had all this cool shit in it. Like there's so many moments like that in here. Like when Patrick Stewart has a skullet, like you see that and you're just like, whoa, what a bizarre choice. Yeah. And like, the cat thing and like the war pug that Patrick Stewart always has, you know?
Oh yeah.
The pug that it has a lot of moments in the movie. It even gets like its own moment once in a while. You just see it running down a hallway for whatever reason. And the scene where we think it's the last time we're going to see Patrick Stewart, he runs into battle while holding the pug, which is a crazy thing to do. And then we see him later and he doesn't have the pug and we think the, you know, we get no closure on the pug. But in the last scene where Paul's walking into the chamber where he's going to fight Fade, like there's a little kid there and he's holding a pug. And you're like, is that the pug?
Is that the same pug?
There's just like weird shit like that in it. The other thing I really love is part of, and I assume this has to do with just like the budget didn't permit anything easier or healthier, but all of the black smoke that's going on during the fight scenes is actually from burning rubber tire, like burning tires.
Oh.
And I don't remember where I took this quote from, but it was somebody on the movie said, accidentally breathing it would stun your vocal cords. And there's actually that might've been Kyle MacLachlan, I think. And he said that he went to talk to Patrick Stewart and like Patrick Stewart started to talk and like couldn't say anything.
Wow.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
But I think my favorite part of the movie is just all of those dreamy hypnotic visuals where Paul, after he like, takes the spice and after he drinks the water of life, that he's able to transcend time and space and like look forward into the future and see, like, I just think all of that stuff is really pretty and cool how it is like doing something interesting in a visual sense and showing us all these images that are going to pay off and make more sense down the line, but also just conveying the theme of somebody becoming more in touch with the world and being in multiple places at once. Like this idea that you have feelings pocketed throughout the universe in that kind of like hippy dippy way where like you you know you're connected with like people from various places and can empathize with like the situation and energies in other places. And you know, it does all this stuff that I think is cool that could have been developed a lot more, and does kind of bum me out that in the end it's the movie's not seen as more of a cautionary tale of like what can happen when you take that energy too far, when you kind of think you rule over all these things, you know, and everyone needs to follow your lead and see the things how you see the world. That to me goes against what David Lynch typically does in his movies. Like that's usually a character's downfall. But in this, it's not really presented that way. So it makes the visuals even more interesting to me though, than that, like all these weird hypnotic dream sequences, like that it's not gonna pay off. Like it doesn't convey the theme that like the movie ends up conveying, yet it like secretly it's what Lynch wants you to think about the movie, you know. I just like all those scenes to me carry that energy to this day for me.
They are beautiful. Again, the shots throughout the movie are great.
Of all the stuff that gets cut out of the movie, I can't believe that's what stayed in. Like that's the most Lynchy stuff right there.
Yeah. It is. It, you know, those sequences, the movie, as you were talking, it made me realize, I feel like this movie, I connected it to the Mario Brothers movie, but I feel like this movie, when you're talking about all the trippy space stuff, I was like, this movie came out 20 years after 2001 A Space Odyssey. Uh-huh. And there's just, you would think that this came out before 2001 A Space Odyssey in some ways. It made me imagine or think about it in terms of like Jason and the Argonauts,
mm-hmm.
like those classic,
yeah,
almost like claymation movies from the, what year were those coming out? Like the 30s, 40s?
Yeah, like old ass movies.
Which I love. Those movies were really cool where you just see the claymation skeleton chasing a human actor, the condor or griffin, yeah, attacking or something.
Those movies were like a dime a dozen back then.
Yeah, there's something about this movie that kind of has that energy
for sure
to me about it,
yeah,
but leveled up, which is kind of cool in some ways. The same way like Blade Runner feels like a culmination of a lot of the noir movies mm-hmm. from the,
yeah,
like 40s and 50s, and just kind of blending it into the sci-fi era, like taking a lot of that Jason and the Argonauts kind of energy and turning it into an 80s sci-fi blockbuster.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, Blade Runner 2 was a movie that was fraught with edits and what the studio wanted, yep, and the cuts and all that. And I think that's just a sign of like, you know, we are in the 80s at this point. That's when the sci-fi movies you're talking about that were really successful in like the 40s, 50s, 60s, and had a certain aesthetic, suddenly studios wanted to capitalize on these things and make a Star Wars and make something bigger. And it became a little bit of a mess and not as simple as what they used to be, and there was something really powerful and attractive and entertaining about their simplicity and about just watching a bunch of dudes go and fight and watching a lame claymation, watching them fight some lame claymation creature. Like there was a sense of fun and levity in that, that I think appealed to a lot of people.
Yeah.
That kind of gets stripped away in this new, like it's there and it's like a bigger version of it. Yet like the editing doesn't always work. Like you can see like the studio just chopped up this fight scene. it doesn't have like the uplifting air of like the older stuff, the kind of like innocent, like these are just a bunch of people getting together to make a movie kind of air. Instead, it's like a big budget mess. So yeah, all that stuff's there, but it's just a little watered down.
And I do, before we get into rankings, the last thing I want to mention, which was, you know, we talked about the flaws in this movie, or there's scenes that maybe don't work. I think there's one just truly egregious thing where I don't even think most of the movie has like egregious moments. It's just like, that's silly, that's goofy, but it kind of works. It's kind of in tone. The one thing I think is absolutely like outrageous is when Jessica and Paul run from the worm after the ship crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up in the rocks and the worms hitting the rocks.
Uh-huh.
And you have the moment where the rock splits open.
Yeah.
And Paul goes sliding down the rock.
He goes down like a little slide like my daughter does at the park.
Yeah. He goes down the slide and then falls for a long time. to the point where he's like falling through the air, striking rocks, rolling, falling again. It was like the scene out of
Hot Rod.
Yeah. What's his face? Just Doesn't goes that make falling you like down. It, I love that scene in Hot Rod, but in Dune, it's just so.
See, you got to get on my wavelength. You see that and you're like, all right, this is what this movie's about.
Yeah, I should, instead of viewing it as an outlier that's ridiculous, I should view it as the benchmark that the Absolutely. Rest of the movie's trying to catch up to. Yeah, but I was just so like, it has to end now, right? No, he just hits another rock and keeps falling and then immediately is just like, oh, I'm going to roll out of this boulder. It's like he would be pulp on the ground. It was such an amazingly over the top. I think in hindsight, I'd probably enjoy it more, but on the first watch, it was so inexplicable to me.
You got to be in the right state of mind, if you know what I mean, Chris.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
Two things I want to mention really quick, and then we'll be done. First of all, you were mentioning references people have made to Dune over the years that, like, I was starting to research this a little bit and realize, like, it's been quoted in songs, like, a ton. And not just, I guess they're probably quoting the novel Dune, but there are exact passages taken out of this movie Dune that I assume, like, it's kind of referring to the movie and the novel. Like, the beginning of Intergalactic starts with the words, well, the spice is the worm and the worm is the spice, which is like an exact line from this movie. And I just think that's hilarious. but yeah, go research that, like all the different like little lyrical nods to Dune. It's great.
That's pretty funny. I wonder how many people have... I know that there's some other movie that I've watched where they go like, spice. But I can't think about...
Some parody.
I can't remember what it is right now.
And the other thing I want to read is... I was looking around. I don't usually do this, but I got on Twitter today. And I was looking around at like people's reactions to Dune. And I found a thread on Lynch's Dune. You know, everyone's generally talking about like, it's cool, but it's a failure. and I found this one tweet that was great. Sorry, I should have... wrote down who wrote this tweet. I'm sorry I didn't. But you made a great tweet, whoever you are.
Tweet.
That's a new website I'm starting by the way, Quitter. where you can tweet
quit on things. Yeah.
Lynch's Dune is great as a Lynch film, which is ironic considering the studio did its best to take the Lynchness out of it and strangely made it even more Lynchian in the process. Lynch. Which I think Knightley wraps up this movie in that, like, it's a failure, but it's a failure where, like, these people were trying to make it not Lynch, and, like, it still was Lynch. So, like, it became more Lynch. Because, like, the whole thing of Mulholland Drive, you know, and a lot of his movies, people are like, kind of in this, like, they're imagining a world or, like, they're living in a fantasy and then they're, like, pulled back into reality. And, like, you could view a lot of this movie that way. Like, Lynch was trying to do that, you know? That this is all just like Paul projecting like how people view him and the kind of man he could become. The guy doing the commentary on Dune made a joke that like, I wouldn't be surprised if like there's another version of Dune where Paul wakes up at the end and he's just a regular guy who's mad he doesn't have more of a place in the world and he goes to the Winkies Diner in Mulholland Drive. So it's just the guy, you know, that talks about his dream.
Yeah. That would be amazing.
Like that I could see Lynch essentially go in for something like that.
Yeah, if he did a reshoot of it and had that be the end, I would be so happy.
That would be a great fan cut.
The tweet was from some_guy_9.
Thank you. You're always Drew really good about mentioning people's handles.
Yeah, I try to give credits.
It's my fault. This is all on me because like I just can't stand being on Twitter and like I would never like want one of my tweets read. So in a way, like I'm hiding you.
You're looking out. I'm putting the magnifying glass. Okay. So where's this rank for you?
Like I said, like even though I understand that it's a flawed movie and that there are plenty of reasons to not like it, I love it for the reasons I like it. It is in my essential category, which is the second highest category for me. It comes in at number 38 of 500. I still have to add a few movies. It's close to 560 at this point.
That's amazing. What an outrageous thing.
And the movie sandwich is Out of Sight from 1998, the George Clooney, Jennifer Lopez rom-com.
Oh, wow.
Which is an incredible movie. It's a Steven Soderbergh movie. One of the prettiest movies I've ever seen. Then Twilight. A movie I love, I've seen many times. These are all movies that like I have a deep connection to that goes beyond like, I think everyone will like this. I'm just like, no, I like this.
Yeah.
Then Dune, then Sideways, the 2004 Paul Giamatti wine romp, and and Jackass the movie.
What a weird place in your rankings.
Yeah.
Those movies existed.
Jackass the movie, by the way, is a masterpiece. Like it's the movie I've seen most removed from a narrative ever. Like it's irreverent in how little it cares about like painting, constructing some sort of story and through line, and more is just like just irreverent. Like people run kids running around and doing stuff they think is gonna entertain you.
Did you see the quote from Denis about dialogue?
No, I have not.
So he has recently been doing press for Dune 2.
Is he? Huh.
And yeah, strange. And he said that movies have been corrupted by TV because I'm not interested in dialogue at all. Pure image and sound, that is the power of cinema. Frankly, I hate dialogue. Dialogue is for theater and TV. I don't remember movies because of a good line.
I agree with him wholeheartedly. I think that's part of what makes, I still think to this day, Polytechnique is his best movie, and it easily has the least talking in it. I connect with all that, and I see that in his movies. Like, part of me wonders if someday I will click with Villeneuve, because he does have a certain aesthetic that just for whatever reason doesn't appeal to me. And like we've talked, like I think it's a little stilted and stale sometimes. That I can never quite penetrate it, but I like everything he's saying. Like I see that he wants to do that. I feel like if those dots can be connected, he makes like my kind of movie.
Yeah, I could see it. I could see it. I'm hoping for it. I'm just hoping for you too.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched Prisoner 3-4 times now trying to like it. I keep making myself like it.
I know. One of these days. Also, my rankings, which are in categories, but within the category, it's not like they're alphabetical.
Yeah.
So Dune comes in at 155 of 197, but that's in the almost category. So it goes almost, not quite, not for me, and really not for me at the bottom.
Okay. I'm surprised it's that high, to be honest.
Yeah. It's right underneath neutral.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of positive. Like, it's mostly the, I can get behind how outrageous it is. And the shots are, like, really gorgeous. And it is a side of one of the, like, I would say a very important filmmaker that you don't otherwise get to see from him,
mm-hmm.
which is very fascinating as well, as just kind of an artifact. To exist. So there's stuff around the movie and within the movie that I think is really cool and like worthwhile. It's just there's also so much within the movie that is patently absurd, that knocks it down some pegs. But that crazy energy that it kind of has at parts, we didn't even talk about how terrifying Aaliyah is. demented and terrified, but then at times you just see it's actually just a little kid walking over rubble and having to do things,
but
which is really funny.
That little kid, and I wish I can get her name right. Oh, Alicia Witt. I found out something crazy about her, and again, like that's part of why I love Dune. Is like every time I read about Dune, like I read about something else crazy that's going on in this movie, and that girl, like. Her parents claim she could speak as soon as she came out of the womb. Like there's all these like reports about her and that she could like describe aerial views of something before ever seeing it, that she could recite Romeo and Juliet by heart, like when she was three. Like there's all this weird stuff about her. And her life and that she, so basically they're positing that when she came to play the Aaliyah part, is it Aaliyah?
Aaliyah,
Paul's sister, that she like already knew the part in a sense, like she was that part.
Oh man, that is
it sounds made up from, but it's still fascinating.
I was gonna say that's such a Hollywood thing, but she's from Massachusetts.
I guess there's some old clip of her on some TV show reciting Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
At an absurdly cool. young age.
Yeah. She's also in Vanilla Sky.
Oh, really?
She plays Libby, but I don't remember who Libby is.
I gotta look this up right now. I want to know. Libby.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's the girl at like the secretary at
the company?
Yeah, at the company.
Okay, nice. I love, like, I'm looking at all of her filmography and there's not really like a lot of movies that you can see that she's like, she had a role in like 2 weeks Notice in 2002, like Last Holiday, 88 Minutes, but there's nothing like big, right?
She's the main girl in Urban Legend. I was looking at her, like, I feel like I recognize her from something. I was just looking at her from Vanilla Sky. Yeah, she's the, I mean, I guess not a lot of people have seen Urban Legend, but it's like, it was like, I mean, it was kind of big at the time. It was like basically a Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer knockoff. And
yeah, I remember the trailers for it and being like, oh man, I really want to see that. And then not catching it in theater, but catching it on HBO and being like, that was really bad.
Yeah, it's kind of like a lame version of those movies.
Yeah. But I'm looking at like her TV roles. I guess she had like a role in Friday Night Lights. Like, it's a lot of stuff from the 90s and like early parts of the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few random like roles here and there. And then on The Masked Singer, she was one of the competitors. Oh. And I was just like, that is such a crazy thing to ask the hosts to know.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's like, Alicia Witts had a very like good career in Hollywood, but at the same time, I don't know if it's a career where if you were singing on a show like Masked Singer, they'd be like, I know who this is. This is clearly Alicia Witt.
Well, on Masked Singer, they get like clues and shit, right?
Yeah, but usually the people that you have on there are like kind of A, B list people.
Yeah, except that crazy guy from Dukes of Hazzard. You hear about him?
Oh, yeah. No.
Well, he was on the show, I know, and I would say that's like, at this point, C list. Like, nobody remembers the guys from Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, it's such a broken and dumb show.
But he said all this stuff about like putting Biden and his son in jail. Like, he was saying like really crazy stuff. It was almost like he was using the Masked Singer as like a platform to get all his message out.
Oh no, what? Something like that?
I know. Okay. Can you believe it?
Crazy. Anything else then?
No, we're gonna be doing, I mean, technically we're doing part two next episode. Like, that's gonna be the episode title, but I imagine we're gonna be talking about both movies.
Yeah, we'll be doing part one and part two when we discuss, so yep. Be ready, Travis, be ready.
I will say that I feel like you described earlier that I have a lukewarm reaction to Dune. I really, really, really hated Dune when I saw it. And I think this will be the first time in my life that I rewatch a movie I hated this much the first time.
Wow.
So, I mean, I've changed since a few years ago, since it came out. Maybe I will be more connected to some of it, but maybe I won't.
It almost makes me wonder if you should watch part two and then go back and watch part one.
Maybe I will. I don't know. Maybe I will. Do you think that's a good idea?
I have no idea.
I probably will watch them in order.
Yeah, I can see watching them in order, but you know the story so well, but yeah, I just watch them in order and see what happens.
But part of it for me is going to be being with Villeneuve's aesthetic and like what he's going for on a visual and tonal level. Like, I do want to be in that and give it another chance like, I know it's not usually my thing, but like sometimes you just need like the right moment and mood for it all to click.
Yeah. And part two does start like right where part one ends. So
that would be weird if it didn't.
Yeah, that's true.
You just miss 2 weeks and they don't explain any of it.
I mean, TV shows love to do that shit.
That was the worst part of, that was maybe the most egregious thing that Dune did for me, in my opinion. Well, not the most egregious, but one of them, when Paul's like giving a little voiceover montage and he's like, 2 years go by.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, right? 2 years?
Like, 2 years? Like, okay, sure. And Aaliyah goes from like just a baby to like a terrifying little person.
Yeah, she's like Bella's daughter.
Yeah.
The true ones get it.
Yeah. What was her name?
Renesmee.
Renesmee, that's it.
A combination of Renee and Esme.
Yeah.
Because who wouldn't do that?
Of course. Of course. It's the logical.
Are you surprised all right. Twilight and Dune are next to each other in my rankings?
No, not at all. Not at all. All right. Well, then, until next time.
All right. You ready, Chris?
Yeah.
All right. No theatrics. We're going to get right to it.
Okay.
Lights.
Camera.
See ya. I don't know why I said it so quickly.
How powerful is Cox Internet? Powerful enough to let your band members in Vegas, Phoenix, and Rhode Island jam like you're all in the same garage. Get gig speeds powered by fiber from Cox. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, always building better. Download speeds up to 1 gigabit per second. Cox Internet is connected to the premises via coaxial connection. Speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms and other restrictions may apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.